Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Each week we bring you interviews and analysis on the struggles affecting poor and working people throughout the U.S. and the world, building the movement for socialism in the United States. I'm your host, Sean Garcia.
And we are here on Liberation Radio. I'm Eugene Puryear, and we are joined this week by Bill Ayers, author most recently of the book Public Enemy, educator and longtime activist and organizer. Mr. Ayers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eugene. I'm happy to be here.
And so first, I wanted to just jump into some of the issues that have been causing a bit of turmoil, in particular around the Black Lives Matter movement, namely the controversy around Teach for America and their involvement, or lack thereof, depending on who you ask, in the broader Black Lives Matter movement. So the first question I want to ask is a little more general, and from your experience as an educator over the years, is this truly something people should be worried about? Is Teach for America, as some have alleged, playing a, quote here, heinous role in destabilizing communities and destroying public education?
Well, okay, this is a huge topic, and we're coming at it from an interesting angle. I've been very supportive of and very energetic in my support of Black Lives Matter. I think it's one of the most hopeful signs that we've seen in the last several years, several decades, of folks coming together and building a movement for fundamental change. And I admire the folks in Chicago, who I know well. I admire them so deeply, and I learn so much from them every time we interact, or every time I have an opportunity to be either in the streets with them or in conversation with them. So that's where I start on the Black Lives Matter question. The other thing about Black Lives Matter is that, you know, there's a lot of mythology around it. There's a lot of sense of, oh, the only reason this is happening is because of social media and because of the use of cameras. And that is fundamentally false. That's not true. What's exciting is that the Black Lives Matter moment comes after decades and centuries of the serial assassination of Black people. That's not what's new. And the technology, while interesting and important, is not the driving force. The driving force is organized young people who've been meeting for years, mobilizing around a lot of issues. And Black Lives Matter, while its focus is, state violence against Black people, its focus is also decent education, stop closing our schools, jobs for everybody, healthcare, mental health, drug programs. So it's a comprehensive movement, and the folks involved in it in Chicago are longtime organizers. So I wanted to start with that. And then you want me to pivot and talk a bit about Teach for America and maybe see what those links are. Is that correct?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, Teach for America, we have to make a distinction here too, Eugene, I think. And that is the folks who are drawn to Teach for America, the young people themselves. And I've met with I've met with so many Teach for America folks, and I have no particular criticism of them. I mean, they go into it for a lot of reasons, and mostly for idealistic reasons. They want to give back. They want to be helpful. They don't see other vehicles to make a difference and so on. And so they go to Teach for America. That's different than the structure of Teach for America and the political thrust of it. Teach for America is part of the corporate school reform. It's part of the market-driven idea that what's wrong with the schools isn't about funding. It isn't about curriculum. It isn't about a kind of a colonial education or an ignorance-based education. Teach for America is part of the move to privatize public schools, eviscerate teachers' unions, and to reduce teaching to a simple mechanical set of activities that lead to rising test scores, rising metrics on a single, standardized test. That is fundamentally backwards and wrong. And I'll get into it in a minute if you'd like to go deeper into it. But just quickly, if you haven't seen, you must see a wonderful YouTube video that comes out of Mad TV called Nice White Lady. Have you seen it, Eugene?
I haven't seen it.
Okay, let me just tell you quickly. You can go online and find it. Just type in Nice White Lady. Mm-hmm. But it's a funny, funny bit, just a few minutes long, with a camera zooming over an urban landscape, and the voiceover is saying, "The American urban high school, there's nowhere more dangerous." And then the camera zooms into a high school classroom, and the voiceover is saying, "Out of control students." And you see these kids sitting on their desks, cleaning their pistols and sharpening their knives. And parents who are who don't give a damn, and lazy, incompetent teachers. And then the door to the classroom opens, and this young, well-scrubbed woman looks in, and she says, "Hi, I'm Amy Little." And the voiceover says, "What could possibly save them?" And this kid looks in and says, "Hi, I'm Amy Little. I'm here to help you." And the kids all growl at her with maximum urban attitude. And one girl goes up in her face and says, "What do you know about me? You know?" And then she tells the litany of her horrible life. And Amy Little, this young woman, is taken aback. And then she reaches for a pen and hands it to the student and says, "Write that down." And soon everybody's winning Pulitzer Prizes and giving up their pistols for pens. And, you know, in the end, they're all dancing in the hallway. And the voiceover says, "So if you want to help save the schools, you don't need, more funding. You don't need better curriculum. You don't need better physical plans. All you need is a few nice white ladies." Now, the reason the satire works is because that's exactly what Teach for America represents. Right. It represents the idea that a few well-intentioned people with some idealism and some, hopefulness and a good liberal arts education from Princeton or Harvard or Michigan can somehow change the fate of schools that are underfunded, overcrowded, too many kids, too little time, too few resources, a disrespected teaching staff. Those are the things that we need to address, and those are the things that Teach for America does not care about one bit. And again, let me make the distinction. Not the young people themselves, but the structure of the thing is completely cynical. And completely backwards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. And, kind of on a related note, I mean, I think that, well, it depends on what city you're in terms of, I think, how the tenor of the struggle is. But I was wondering if you could just say a little more about, what's sort of the importance of, because we talk a lot in Black Lives Matter about, sort of very direct connections between, say, policing and affordable housing and jobs and things like that. And education is in there. But where is it fit sort of in the firmament of, this broader struggle of oppressed communities for dignity?
Well, I mean, I think you can't, there is no single issue, there is no single struggle that amounts to the kinds of transformation we need. What we need is a real social upheaval, a real a social movement which engages and mobilizes masses of people. And frankly, Black Lives Matter at this moment is a pretty good beginning example of that. And then we have to see that all the issues are connected, that one thing is not the only thing that's going on. So you have to beware in any movement. First of all, in any movement, the response of power is always the same. First, they ignore you. Then they ridicule you. Then they try to co-opt you with a few little reforms. And then if nothing else works, they beat the heck out of you. Mm-hmm. And then they repeat. So this is what's happening with Black Lives Matter, the attempt to co-opt it, the attempt to patronize it, the attempt to, by power is what I mean. Right. So you have on the one hand the reactionaries, the people like FBI Director Comey, who comes out and says crime is up and the police are afraid because they've been targeted. And really, the scrutiny, literally, Comey says, the scrutiny on police officers is causing problems in the community. Now, what universe is he living in? I mean, that he imagines that policing in a free or democratic society involves saying to the cops, "Hey, do your dirty work and we won't watch." That's ridiculous. In any free society, the police are under the control of the sovereign, which is us, the people. Mm-hmm. But that's not how he sees it. So he literally says, we need, police need more confidence. They need more force. They need good old-fashioned, go up to a group of guys on a corner and say, "What are you doing here at 1 a.m? And my response to that is to say, get out your camera and ask the cops what they're doing in that corner at 1 a.m. How dare he say that we don't have the right to stand on a corner at 1 a.m. because the police are looking out for the safety of the community? That's nuts. But it's never a simple or a single issue. So what we have to do is connect, you know, militarized police and, you know, and militarized kind of occupation of some communities. They have to link that with the fact that there are no jobs in those communities, that the healthcare, the mental health facilities in Chicago have all been closed in those communities. The hospitals have been stripped of their resources in those communities. And 50 Chicago public schools were closed. And just this morning, the Chicago City Council just raised everybody's taxes and for the first time in history, charged a fee for garbage. Now I want to show you how crazy it is, just for 1 second.
Mm-hmm, please.
They not only are going to charge a fee for garbage pickup for the first time, they're going to tie it to your water bill, which means if you don't pay your garbage fee, they'll turn off your water.
Jesus.
Where are we? What land are we living in? And it really does feel in some communities, and this is not even across America. That's something that we always understand. When we say the schools are in crisis, we don't mean the schools in the wealthy communities or for the wealthy people. So when we say that some communities feel like they're occupied and they have the blue light cameras going off and the police confronting people on silly, petty things that they would never confront anyone on in a rich community. You saw that video, my heart is just bleeding for this young woman in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. See the video of the cop dragging her from, what did she do? She was sitting in her classroom. She didn't do anything. And yet violence against black children is just assumed to be okay. But that's what we have to kind of see, that and him attacking her, police in the schools in some communities, not all, police attacking students in schools. This is commonplace in schools for the poor. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the issues are linked at their base, and what the real issue is that we live in a society in which, you know, not only do we have the 1% and the 99%, but we have a history of oppression and privilege based on race, and it's at the very center of the American story. It's not some side problem. It's at the very center of our story from the beginning of this country until now. And we need to see the ways in which it expresses itself through unequal education, through lack of job opportunities, through taxation and redlining and mass incarceration. All these things are linked up. And when we, whatever struggles we're involved in, for example, the main focus of my work for 2 decades or 3 decades has been schools. And I understand, and I have to understand and make explicit, that struggling for decent schools for the children of formerly enslaved people, for the children of immigrants from poor nations, for the children of First Nations people, that struggle is linked to decent health care and opportunities for jobs and police who act not as occupiers, but as public servants, who are under citizen control, under citizen surveillance, as they should be and as they should want to be. Mm-hmm. But we don't live in that society. That's the society we have to build a massive movement to create.
Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to that too. But one thing that you mentioned that I definitely want to pick up on is this issue of co-option. Obviously, the 2016 election's in full swing here, so it's happening. And you know, there's a lot of different debate and things happening in the movement. So I know you may not necessarily want to put your thumb on the scale, but from your experience, you know, what are some of the ways that those of us who are activists in Black Lives Matter and other, I guess, youth movements, progressive movements, how should we be approaching this issue of co-option as sort of now everyone wants the Black Lives Matter merit badge, as I say? So how do we navigate these waters to a degree?
I like that. I like that phrase, the merit badge. And when you say everyone, of course, you mean liberals and maybe some of the people running for, you know, office in the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
The Republicans don't want that merit badge. Oh, they want the James Comey merit badge for being, you know, harsh and miserable. But yeah, you're right. I mean, but this is the way of every movement. And I want to clarify, and I think you were you're hinting at this. I don't really have advice for you or for the activists. I want to take advice from you. I want to learn from you. So I don't have, you know, I'm 70 years old. So, you know, I have been involved in a lot of movements. But frankly, I don't think that where you're going to look and find the real wisdom for your movement is in folks who were fighting battles, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. I think the wisdom is going to come from the room itself. The wisdom is in the room. And unlocking that wisdom and trusting each other, that's the way to go. But I will say this, in my own activism, which has not ended, and frankly, when the barricades are put up, the real big barricades, I plan to be there. I might be in a wheelchair.
And I plan to well, throw we'll help myself you up if onto
those
to.
Barricades. And I want you to clear a path for me so I can get there. But the truth is that every social movement and every, I would think it's not only about being a social movement, it's about social activists, it's about being a good citizen, it's about being a moral person. There's a rhythm that you have to follow, and we all know this, but it's worth saying, you have to open your eyes and see the world as it really is. And that's not something you do once or twice and then put it on automatic pilot. The world's too dynamic and it's too vast. You have to open your eyes every day and try to make sense about what you see. The second step is you have to be astonished at everything you see in front of you, astonished at the joy, the ecstasy, the love that's taking place on hard surfaces, the beauty of people loving each other, and you have to be astonished at the cruelty that human beings visit upon one another. And then the third step is you have to act. You act imperfectly. You don't know what you're doing. Of course, you can't see everything. You don't know the consequences completely, but you must act. And then after you act, you must doubt. That is, you must rethink. You must reconsider. And in that doubting, I think there's an important standard. And the standard is, did I educate and did I learn? Did I teach and did I learn? If I taught people something by the sacrifice I made or by the action I took, then that's good. If I learned something from it, that's also good. But if the only thing that happened from my action was that I looked good on TV or I loved my pose as I hurled the rock through the window, no, that's not the standard you're trying to achieve as an organizer, as an activist, as a revolutionary. The goal is mass education. The goal is learning every day more about yourself, more about your capacity, more about your comrades, more about your movement. So that's where I start as kind of a framework for thinking. It doesn't answer anything. It only tells you to keep opening your eyes, keep being astonished. You know, when I say be astonished, what I mean is don't become cynical. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, yeah, we tap our phones. No. They tap our phones, that outrages me. You know, I mean, I got to be astonished at that. You see what I'm saying? So I don't want to be complacent. I don't want to be cynical. I want to be amazed at how beautiful we are and also how long the road is. And so that's my basic rhythm of activism. Now, let's talk 1 minute about co-optation.
Please.
Every movement, it's not Black Lives Matter per se. It's every movement ever in history. Somebody moved in to try to contain it and co-opt it. You want a real huge lesson in it? Just look at the kind of machinations and complexities, some of which were overcome, some of which we couldn't, involved in the Black Freedom Movement of the 60s and the 50s and 60s. That was a movement that was threatening the very foundation of this country, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And noteworthy is that, you know, Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, was not part of the Black Freedom Movement. He was a cracker from Texas who responded to fire from below. Mm-hmm. Our job is to create the fire from below and to not allow ourselves to be used. So note, in the film Selma, which I'm sure you've seen, you know, Lyndon Johnson is asking King to meet with him. Mm. King's not begging the boss for a meeting. Lyndon Johnson's trying to contain the revolution, you know, and that's a different relationship. You know, so I could go back in history and talk more about that. But my point is, co-optation is as natural as rain. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And our job is to keep our eye on the deeper issues we care about. So what do we care about, for example, in Black Lives Matter? We don't care about, we're not fighting for cameras on police vests any more than we were fighting for buses 1964 or 5. We weren't fighting for buses to bus people to school. We were fighting for justice. We were fighting to end racism. And remembering that means you might take a bus, but that's not the end of the struggle. That's only a tactic. That's only a concession. There's more to do. And getting deeper and going further is always our job. Opening our eyes, educating people about what the real terms are, connecting the issues, you know, war and warming and racism and homophobia. These things are connected. We have to fight them all by connecting them all. But we start where we are and dive into the contradiction as forcefully as you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's actually a beautiful place to bring it to a close. And I just want to thank you again for joining us here on Liberation Radio. And again, this was Mr. Bill Ayers, most recently the author of Public Enemy.
Yeah, okay.
And thank you so much. I do appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Eugene. And keep doing what you do. I really admire it. Thanks
I
so
absolutely
much.
Will. Absolutely.
What can I say? Let me explain this to you. To you.